welcome to A Card Knock Life. This is episode 6. We are here with your host, John Gell. John, say hi.
Hey.
Daryl Feldman.
What's up?
And I am Corey Murphy. Brandon Semerow will probably be joining us later on. Fingers crossed. He is MIA right now, but we do plan on having him on. But sadly, we are 4 Caballeros tonight, as we were last week, and we'll probably continue in that way for a little bit here. As a reminder, we are doing a new format with our podcast rather than the typical cut and dry deck review from the weekend's events. We will talk about a little bit of that stuff, but the way that we're going to do this is we're going to break it down by host, and each one of us has in our show notes two or three things that we're going to talk about. Basically what we did over the weekend or what we did as far as Magic goes, what happened over the weekend and you know, on other places, other events, any news and just any general discussion stuff that we want to cover. So expect that, you know, based on our individual focuses, we'll have kind of different segments broken down in that way. And actually, John's going to kick us off with that.
Yeah, so I'm going to talk a little bit about Standard here today. There's some big tournaments that came about this weekend. This is the first trial for the regional PTQ system that Wizards has put in place, where they've got, you can basically fly or drive or go to any RPTQ you want to try to qualify for the Pro Tour. And I think it was an exciting process. Like, I didn't qualify, but I was testing with a lot of guys that were qualified, and two of them, well, a couple of them actually were in top 8 in Chicago, which was one of the biggest RPTQs, and two of the guys that I know from Madison ended up qualifying. So it was good to see some of those finishes, and it was interesting to see some of the breakdowns of this new RPTQ system. I linked you guys to this article, and it'll be in the show notes, but it kind of breaks down the numbers in terms of what was what they were trying to predict and then what ultimately happened. And it's interesting. I don't know. I'm curious to see what you guys think about this new system.
So basically the issue with it was that the attendance was like really unpredictable, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, some numbers were close, for the most part. I think, you know, it was kind of up and down depending on the region. It looks like there was some flight from some of the bigger regions. People obviously didn't want to have as tough a competition, so they went to smaller cities, and so, you know, but some of the numbers were just crazy with it. I mean, like, Chicago ended up being 113 people, and so the top 4 would qualify for the Pro Tour, but if they had hit 128, they would have had 8 slots. So, I mean, that was basically about as hard a RPTQ as you could possibly play in. Versus one of my buddies went out that was testing with us to Portland because he was going on vacation, and the one out there was only 42 people, the same number of slots.
So is it anything between 0 and 128 attendees has 4 qualifier slots?
Yep.
Okay.
So like New Mexico, for instance, was predicted to have 25 people, and I think people kind of got on board with that because I was talking about it, other people I knew were talking about it, and that seemed to be kind of the soup du jour. And people went out there, and it turned out to be like 50 people or something in New Mexico instead of 25.
Okay.
So still really small, but obviously more than predicted.
Yeah. And so, like, maybe you don't have access to this information, but since this this RPTQ system started, how many PTQs are there, like, roughly per maybe region? I don't know. I mean,
yeah, that was the other interesting thing, was that I think there were 2,300 PPTQs over the whole world, and 300 slots just went empty. Nobody showed up to the RPTQ. So, I mean, it sounds like a small number out of 2,300, but that seems super startling to me because that means 300 people actually played in a big qualifier, you know, smaller qualifier, and didn't cash in their qualification ticket. And some of the things, they were showing the numbers on it, and a lot of it was in North America and Europe, where you even have more chances to qualify, and travel is maybe a little bit easier than some other places. But, you know, the bottom line they were saying is that maybe it's too expensive to travel for some people, or you don't have your buddies coming along to some of these events and that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, if it's just one weekend, like, people have stuff going on, you know?
That's the other thing, too.
So I think the really interesting thing about this is that, you know, they're trying to limit the whole design of this was to limit the Pro Tour size.
Well, and that so and the fact that PTQs were, you know, overwhelming these locations, these venues too.
Right. So that's sort of the point is they were trying to limit the Pro Tour size by, you know, saying, I don't want, you know, John Galley, if he runs hotter than the sun, to get a free ride to the Pro Tour. He's going to have to run hotter than the sun.
But I need that hot run.
And then run hotter than the sun again to get to the Pro Tour. So he's actually going to have some amount of skill to get there. So I think that is something that happens. But I think they have to, with the regional PTQ system, actually have to create regions where they say people like in America.
Lock them in.
Portland. You know, if you're in Seattle, if there's none in Seattle, you know, if you're in Washington and Oregon, you're going to Portland. If you're in California, you're going to the one in San Diego.
Yeah, I feel like that change will get made too, because if the numbers show anything, it shows that people bounced around a lot. And, you know, maybe that also, if more people are going to a specific one, it'll help people who are traveling and stuff. Like, I saw even on Reddit, like, people were trying to see if anybody out there had a car to take them because they couldn't get out there themselves, but they were qualified. So
I just think like, and it's the thing about the RPTQs that I think really bothers me a lot is that it takes away a lot of the gamesmanship and camaraderie that you get from just standard PTQing in 5K. Because if you PTQ in the Midwest, you know guys like Lewis Kaplan and Caleb Durward and Owen Turnwall, you know, when he was PTQing, like, you knew those guys. Like, you met them. They were at all the PTQs trying to qualify, trying to get back on the train, trying to stay on the train. So you saw these guys at all the tournaments. And you knew that, you know, they were sort of like the end bosses. And it made the tournament, like, much more interesting. Could you dodge the end boss until you had to play him? Could you beat the end boss and get yourself into the top eight? You know, were you going to see him at the end and, like, have, you know. So there was, like, star power in each region.
Yeah,
and
no, that's
so I think
a good
that kind of was a neat little generating bit for Magic that I think the website you sent out said, what if they did like a Magic the Gathering desk centered in Washington and had, you know, professional correspondents like LSV in California and like X guy in you know, in Chicago.
Well, and that
things like that, because then you could also build the Midwest star power by locking in the region. You could say, this guy's a hot up-and-comer. This guy spiked a PTQ here. And so you can have backstories on coverage and things like that. And it would actually be a really neat thing to grow Wizards brand by having like the concept of a Magic the Gathering news desk, like covering dawn to dusk every RPTQ around the world. So like if you lock in the regions, you allow the ability to create star power in the regions. Say, well, this guy's qualified for the past like 5 RPTQs. He just hasn't been able to break yet. So he's kind of like the end boss, but he hasn't been able to break the streak. You know, can he break the streak and quick crush and crush people's dreams today and get into the top 4 of this RPG.
Right.
So I think it's a neat, like, if you lock in the regions, you allow for something cool like this to develop.
Yeah, Daryl, I thought that was one of the best points of the article. I mean, mostly it was coverage based because they were talking about how there's only like 3 or 4 RPTQs that had live coverage. And like you said, you can build the game and build the players that way, and I definitely think it's worthwhile. I was honestly surprised that there wasn't more live streams. But yeah, like you said, I mean, there's no incentive for somebody from, say, like when Kaplan lived in Iowa, he'd come over here all the time to play in PTQs, and there's just not really an incentive to do that anymore, unless you just are just so diehard at qualifying and have been struggling and stuff. But even then, I mean, there's just usually something closer on a given weekend.
So you're saying that there are enough opportunities nearby to your home that you don't have to travel, right?
Yeah, during season, you know, usually every weekend there's something within an hour and a half, you know, and usually in your home state.
I mean, is that true out west in, like, you know?
That's not true out west. My buddy who lives in Phoenix was saying the PPTQs are much larger there because there's not as many of them, and they're not in as many easy to get to locations.
Uh-huh.
But I do think there's still a lot more stores involved because of the lower requirements. I mean, basically you have to find an L2 judge, which is not a super easy requirement, but you know, it's enough that a store can run something they typically wouldn't have run before.
Hmm.
So, But I want to give a quick shout out to, speaking of Lewis Kaplan, congratulations if he's listening to this at all, because he qualified in Chicago, and he's been playing as long as I have, and he has had numerous finals and top eight appearances and been super close to getting on the tour and has never made it up until this point.
Cool.
And then Fan Chen Yang, who is plays at Mox with us all the time and been playing a little bit of a shorter career, but he also qualified. Very happy for him.
So what do you walk away with in the RPTQs? Is there a cash prize that you get in the top eight?
So that's the other thing. Not really any prize. Top 16 gets a playmat, which is awkward already because you haven't qualified for anything if you make top 16 at the RPTQ. Right. And then there's no prize at all. You get the Liliana that you get for coming, and then you don't get anything except for the invite if you top four or top eight, depending on the qualifier. So it was just like
old school PTQs, all about the blue envelope, baby.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I mean, there's some positives, I think, that came out of it. I'm blanking on what they are right now. But
yeah, well, I mean, the Liliana.
I think one of the things was that I kind of expected these things to be just impossible tasks. When I saw the system come out, I was like, basically, like, I think I'm done with Magic at this point, because my main goal is to qualify for a Pro Tour, and this makes it so hard, I thought. But after seeing that a lot of these are 50 to 100 people, you basically just have to play, you know, five or six rounds of Magic and, you know, play your game, and you can qualify. Like, making it a top four or top eight is definitely easier than having to win the whole thing.
Yeah, you have to spike a PTQ or a PPTQ, which is the hard part. Like, sometimes winning a 40-person tournament is just a pain in the butt. But, like, if you can snake your way through that, then you get into a more manageable position of, like, play tight, you know, build your deck right, and make a top eight, and then win a match, and you've made the Pro Tour. So it's like, it's you can do it in much more manageable pieces than playing in a 9-round PTQ and hoping you run white hot and, like, hope you didn't make the wrong card choice because you cut Faded Conflagration because for some reason Siege Rhino's on the downfall, and then you just play like Siege Rhino, Siege Rhino, Siege Rhino, and your opponents just crush you into the ground. Well, so like something like that. You don't like you made a bad meta call, and so like you just blew your chance to top eight the PTQ. So
I think also the one way I pictured it was that there's going to be this big qualifier with every round you're going to play an end boss, and I think actually in reality it's not quite that way, because a lot of these PPTQs are really small. There was a couple I knew of that were like less than 15 people, you know, so you may not have everybody's like a stellar Magic player. I mean, they probably are halfway decent, but, you know, not everybody's, you know, one of the Pro Tour players. And also, I think if you put in the time and testing, I mean, you can see results. Like, the crew I tested with, two of the guys made top eight. One of them lost to Kaplan in the top eight, so that's how Kaplan got his qualification. And then the other guy qualified. And then another guy from Madison was just on the bubble. So, I mean, if you're in a good region and you play good Magic and you practice and you put the time in, like, it doesn't seem as impossible as I first thought.
Right. Well, speaking of, like, value for this experience, I mean, these Lilianas, they're, what, you said 2,000 people out of the 2,300 that got invited showed up.
Right, so, and you don't get it unless you show up too. So
okay, so there are 2,000 foil Lilianas in circulation, the promos.
Yeah, with the bubble on the bottom of them.
Okay, what is that going to do to the price of Liliana? I mean, that's a really small sample size there. And what is that promo going to be worth?
I think it'll just be a chase promo, you know.
Yeah, that promo will probably be $200-$300, maybe $400, depending on what foil Liliana is sitting at. Let me do some, you know, investigative journalism right now.
Liliana non-foil is about $80. Foil, $200.
So they'll sit at about $350-$400 probably, just because they're so chased.
So there you go. You made money just for going.
All right. I mean, you paid for your travel, which is kind of the interesting thing to me, is that some of these folks that, you know, had a tough time getting there maybe or whatnot, I mean, shit, if you can get over there, you've got your travel paid for. You could just go turn around and sell to the dealers and, you know, probably make a minimum of $200. So, I don't know, that kind of baffled me a little bit, but there's certainly a number of reasons, and, like, I don't know, I think, Daryl, you mentioned, like, you know, it's the one weekend that you can go. And like for me, if I had qualified, a very good friend of mine had a bachelor party this Saturday, and like I probably wasn't going to miss that. I mean, it would be a hard call for me, and I'm not the only one that'd be in a situation like that. So
yeah, or if you get sick. People get right. sick sometimes. Hey, I'm looking on eBay. These foil Ilianas are going for 160, 100, buy it now, 190.
Or it's early too. You know, first week after, they're going to try to bite on people that, you know, have to dump it for money and stuff. But I could definitely see that card going up in value once some time has passed.
Yeah. So, I don't know, maybe in the long run. Depends on what like, Modern Masters has, right?
If they would have done a different art for it.
Yeah, that was the weird thing.
Yeah, instead of the original art, like if they had done like a Geist of Chaintraft-esque alt art for it, it would have probably been more. But I think just a regular art, it might hang around regular foil price. Even though there's only like 2,000 of them with that weird bubble on the bottom of them from the N15, like the silver, this is a real card bubble, which kind of bothers me, but we'll leave that for another day.
Yeah, that was weird, but I'll move on here too because I know we've kind of spent some time on this RPTQ. I guess we could talk a little bit about how the standard format is evolving here. The big deck 2 weekends ago was Esper Dragons, which dominated the top eight of what we affectionately call GP Kraken. And so that was the big target that everybody was practicing for. And Madison here, when we were testing, we were trying different ideas. We were going over a Den Protector, Deathmist Raptor Shell, and Abzan because a couple of our guys here play Abzan aggro. And then I saw that Andrew Tenjum and Matt Hoey, which I've got the lists up there for, they ended up playing a list just like that. And our guy Paul that went out to Portland played a list like that as well, because that's what we have been talking about. Just basically to get some more value to beat Esper. And it turned out, like, it looked like on camera from what I saw that it did help the matchup quite a bit. But Esper Dragons is still just a ridiculous deck in standard. I still think even as a red player, it's probably the number one deck, and it's not close.
Yeah, man, I'm already getting tired of seeing it. It's only been 3 weeks since the Pro Tour. I'm starting to forget that it's that's not a long period of time that this deck has even been in existence, but I've played it so many freaking times.
Yeah. I mean, it's popular.
Deck is a work of art. Thank you, control decks.
But, you know, and it's kind of like right now we're getting a little rock, paper, scissors where it's like decks sure. that beat Esper Control... Decks that beat Esper Control and Esper Control.
Well, that and also like a lot of the guys and I were talking about how, you know, the format is always so close in terms of percentages that, you know, even if you have a 64 or 40-60 matchup against Esper or 55-60, 45, it's, you know, they're still winnable games. So if you're good with a deck, if you play Abzan, for instance, for a long time, you know, you can make little tweaks and help your percentages enough that it's not that bad, but the deck is very good. I mean, Tarka Red has been a big deck for me, and I thought that deck is still competitive, but games 2 and 3 against Esper are incredibly challenging.
Yeah, I believe it.
So, yeah, like you said, you're kind of sick of seeing it. It's not going to be the mono black of last season, but it's definitely it's a big dog right now. I think it's opened up some design space, though, or at least some space. Like you were talking about rock, paper, scissors. There's some decks that haven't been played for a couple months that the enemies for them are not really out there right now. Like my buddy Brad and I were talking about Jeskai. We're both big fans of Jeskai, Manus Rider, aggro, and that was always pretty well positioned against control. And the things that kind of harp on it, like Mono Red's kind of quieting down a little bit, and you know, some of the tokens builds that have been good against it are quieting down. So that could be a good choice. It had a couple finishes this weekend, and I don't know, it could be an interesting deck for the future here.
Yeah, the deck only runs, like, I mean, I've seen 3 main deck Crux of Fates in just about every list. Does that seem pretty standard to you guys?
Usually 2 is the standard, unless that increased a little bit this weekend. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's not like sweepers are the game plan. The game plan for them really is that they want to have their heroes downfall or their dissolve or some kind of early interaction, and they want to stake a dragon relatively early. Which can benefit you, too, because if you're playing cards like Foul Tongue Invocation or Crackling Doom in a Mardu list, for instance, kind of like the one that did well this weekend, you can take advantage of the fact that your opponent sometimes will play too quickly with the deck.
Oh, yeah, that's a huge thing. Like, though this deck is played, like, so frequently right now, there are so many people that are not doing it to its full potential and are tapping out for dragons and stuff. And I think the guys who play it really conservatively and play Drago for a while before they actually resolve a dragon are the ones that are, you know, like, I think that's the way to go. Like, you can really punish those guys that are tapping out for Dragonlord Ojutai in turn 5. Mm-hmm. Then the gates are open, you know?
I mean, that's exactly how your Drago control decks work. Like, you sit there and you wait for a while and you hang out. If they make you do something, I guess you press the okay, I'll do this button. And if not, you cast a spell that draws you X cards and you play another land and you pass. And unfortunately, we don't have a dragon with flash. Otherwise, that would be excellent. But, like, you know, you just tap out on, like, turn 11 for Ojutai with, like, Dissolve Silumgar scoring up. And you go, I don't think you can beat that. Go ahead.
Well, I think this deck's so powerful that you don't even necessarily have to wait that long, so I can understand why players pull the trigger a little faster. But, you know, I think the main reason is, one, because unless they do have a sac effect, you know, Ojutai is probably not dying, and you can just sit untapped with him until you're, you know, ready to go. But also because of the fact that you have Anticipate, you have Ojutai's built-in Anticipate, and you have Dig Through Time. So even if a situation goes badly, it's really easy for that deck to crawl out of it.
Right, right. Yeah, the draws are like so abundant.
What was the
first one? The first set, like the Pro Tour decks, there was the Esper Dragon deck and then the Blue Black Dragon deck. And the Esper Dragon deck, I can't remember exactly what that looked like. That was in the Pro Tour, but I'm thinking that was closer to what we see today. And like the Blue Black deck stuff, like, has pretty much totally phased out. Like, that deck was running the Jace's Ingenuities and draw instead of Anticipates.
Yeah, I think the Blue Black is, like, relatively decent against the Dragons build at times, especially because, like, Perilous Vault is kind of a tough card for the Dragons deck to deal with, since really they can only lay, like, you know, their one threat or two threats at a time. But I don't think the Blue-Black deck's very good against the field, and I think that's why it's struggled, because people see how easy it is with Esper that they just would rather play the easier deck.
Well, I'm thinking of the Asuka one,
Was he straight blue-black? I thought he was
blue-black
Esper.
Yeah, no, Yusuke was blue-black. Yusuke and Adrian were blue-black. Yusuke was blue-black dragons. Adrian was just straight blue-black.
Yeah, so it didn't take long. Like, Icefall Regent was in both of those lists, and he's, like, totally gone now. I mean, this deck is, like, it has become such a stock list at this point. Like, I've seen very little differences in the Esper Dragons decks that are showing up.
Well, it's just a lot of, like, that Dungeon Geist effect isn't really big. Like, tapping a guy down and having a 4-3 flyer isn't a huge deal in this format. Like, if it were, you know, a format of, like, 5-mana guy, go. All right, I'll play my 5-mana dragon, ice your 5-mana guy, go. You either have to tap out to kill it and maybe be able to untap your guy next turn and hope I don't play another Icefall Regent, or play another guy, and if you play one guy. But no, we're in a format full of, like, 2-mana, 3-mana, 3-3s, and then, like, gigantic dragons. So yeah. There's no, like, real mid-range creature. It's like a 4-mana 4-4 with an effect or something that, like, people are playing.
Well, I think, too, one of the things that helps this Esper Dragons deck become so good is that this format is, like you said, Daryl, you know, you're one way or the other, but in general it's kind of slow. You know, other than, like, Red Aggro and Abzan Aggro having a really powerful start, you can just pick off threats and then get to your end game very easily with this deck. And I think that's what really punishes people. It's also got, you know, Thoughtseize usually, so you just really can rip apart most openers and not have to worry too much. But before we segue here, because, Corey, I want to get into what you're talking about, because you're going to talk a little about control. Yeah. I think as a finance spec, I think that Den Protector Deathmist Raptor could be pretty interesting right now. I'm not sure what today's numbers look like, but Saturday and Sunday, Den Protector was still sitting at about 450 on TCG mid, and Deathmist, I think he's still in the 15 to 20 range, but
currently in Star City, Deathmist Raptor $19.
Star City will be expensive, but it's still under 20
and $30 in foil out of stock, so they'll go up again because they're out of stock. And Den Protector's a little high; it's $6 and then $9 for the foil.
I don't think everybody knew about, like, the shell with Abzan either. I mean, we kind of figured that out after doing a lot of testing, and so did the crew that did well at the SCG. But, like, I think now that people see it and saw it a lot on camera, that, you know, they'll want to pick up these cards, because it wasn't even just Abzan. There's a ton of decks jamming this package, Bant, and, you know, just a bunch of decks that realized it was going to be good value. So Maybe Mastery of the Unseen too. I don't know what that's sitting at right now, but that was usually just cheap. A couple bucks. Yeah,
it's cheap.
So, but Den Protector is the one that sticks out to me because it's like $450, and even though it's a normal rare, it was in a ton of decks, like decks that weren't even trying to do the full package. It was just trying to get the Hermit, not Hermit Drew, but Eternal Witness effect. Yeah.
Yeah, those are two very different cards. One of them is very broken.
Yeah, Hermit Drew's real broken.
Hey, they both get you lands off the top of your deck.
All right.
Cards in your yard.
I don't know what world you're living in, but sure.
Is that not true? That's true.
Hermit Druid is never played in a way that puts a basic land into your deck, into your hand. It's played in a way that puts your graveyard or deck into your graveyard. So, okay.
All right, I've squabbled forever, so Corey, take it over here.
All right, well, this is a perfect segue, John. I'm so glad you brought this up. Talking about beating control, if control is as prevalent as it is, we got to kind of figure out how to counteract it, right? And you're onto something with the Deathmist Raptor and the Den Protector shell, which obviously is working since it's like half of the decks are the Esper control decks in last weekend's results, and the other half were the Deathmist Raptor and Den Protector ones. It seems like Fleecemane Lion's really good right now too. If you can get that out on turn two, you can usually play that before Silumgar Scorn is online or before Dissolve is online. And then they play a lot of Ultimate Price main deck, and he's obviously multicolored. So if you can Monstrous a Fleecemane Lion, I think it's GG.
They still have Foul Tongue Invocation, but yeah.
That's true, they have Foul Tongue.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. Like, Monstrous Fleecemane Lion, speaking as a control player that played through that a lot of standards with Fleecemane Lion, it feels like now, even though it's only been two. That guy is a freaking nightmare.
He's awesome.
He's very good, yeah.
at least enough early pressure to kind of like put them within kill range.
Yeah,
Foul Tongue is a problem.
Yeah, Watch Wolf is unbelievably annoying. And then Watch Wolf that just can't ever die and you can't ever touch it ever. It makes it even worse. So it's like the really awkward part is like against those like aggressive decks, you want to play like your other removal spell being Drown in Sorrow.
Yeah.
But you can't do that because it never kills Deathmist Raptor or Fleecemane Lion. So like you have to like go into the white side of Esper to play more Wraths. But right. That's really awkward because it's your flesh color.
Foul Tongue's been like, kind of the go-to card, too. Yeah. That was the big upgrade this weekend, is that a lot of them played that realizing it was good against both Mono Red and Abzan Aggro. But you're right, Daryl. I mean, like, if they get too much stuff on the board, like, then you are forced to consider more Wraths or different strategies. I saw that Abzan Aggro, some lists were even playing Crux of Fate. There's a lot of discussion about that. Simply to hit, like, Ojutai and leave your board intact. So that was kind of interesting.
Well, the other one that I was getting at was Mist Cutter Hydra, which hasn't been around lately. But I know that the removal is all black, but think about the the cannot be countered clause. Protection from blue clause is relevant as a finisher. When you're playing a really long game, you draw into that, can't be countered, can't be blocked because all their creatures are blue.
Yes. It rides an interesting line because one of the battles that Esper control players are facing right now is whether to play Bioblight or Ultimate Price. And Ultimate Price is not very good against Abzan Aggro, but Bioblight obviously is. So if they went more of the Bioblight route, then Mistcutter Hydra, I think, has a little more playability room. But ultimately, I don't really personally like to walk into removal a lot like that. I mean, like you said, Corey, you can take advantage of situations, but against control, you don't know if those will necessarily present themselves.
Right. Well, they tap out. I mean, they tap out for a dragon, and you get in with that. You're right that the removal is cheap when it's like a Murderous Cut or an Ultimate Price or something along those lines, but there are times where that's a total blowout. Anyways, so I guess what I'm getting at here is I played Standard last weekend. I played FNM, and I haven't played Standard in a while, but I've been kind of toying around with it online to prepare for some, actually, PPTQ this weekend, possibly in Appleton. And I think I've decided on a deck based on those experiences. I went 3-0 at Standard, and it wasn't like an extremely competitive metagame, but I did play against three real decks. I played Abzan Aggro, I played Esper Control, and I played, what was the other one? Maybe Jeskai Tokens. And I was running the Sultai Whip deck. Not the the most recent iterations I've seen of that, and it hasn't been showing up a whole lot, but the most recent ones I've seen are the Deathmist Raptor and Den Protector shells. They actually like run four of each of those guys in the main deck. But mine is more like the Reed Duke Sultai Whip that that he was playing a couple weeks ago at the Star City Games Open. I think he won with it. And I've got the list in the show notes, but I'm going to just kind of hit that real quick because it's a pretty awesome deck. It feels like the standard equivalent to Birthing Pod. It's very like utility with the Sidisi Undead Vizier in there. It's got two of those. But then the creature suite that you can fetch out are like Dragonlord Silumgar, Silumgar Drifting Death, Soul of Innistrad, two Tassigers, one Dragonlord Atarka. I actually splashed red for that one Dragonlord Atarka in there.
Yeah, I was going to say, it looks like there's only one, and I'm just curious why there's not, like, a second one. Because I feel like that effect is powerful enough that if you want one, you probably want two.
I'll tell you in a second. Hang on.
Yeah, by all means. I mean, go ahead.
And then Tauren Elemental is in there, too. So, first of all, I'll say this. Tauren Elemental was a total blowout. My favorite card to play all day long. So many awesome interactions. Like, I had a freak on board against Abzan Aggro. And I exiled my Tauren Elemental from my graveyard to Frieza to get a snake to block. And then I could cast the Tauren Elemental from exile after that. It's pretty great.
Oh, jeez.
The tap effect when it attacks is relevant in a lot of games where you go into like board stall. And then this guy comes out of nowhere. And a lot of people don't even know that clause exists. I beat a guy playing Selesnya. That's what the other deck was. It was Selesnya Mastery of the Unseen. And I beat him because he basically tapped out for a giant Genesis Hydra. I got like a Whisperwood Wood Elemental. I had an insane board. But I had Torrent Elemental sitting on board with Xaxes, 13 damage. And when I attacked, he was like, wait, let me
What? 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 Yeah.
The best moment in Magic when your opponent has to turn your card around.
Yeah.
And then they die. So, yeah, I think that card's awesome as like a one of too. I'm glad you didn't run more than that.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a perfect one of. And having the two, I've got two Sidisi Undead Vizier in the deck, the Demonic Tutor Sidisi. And so I can fetch out, you know, whatever piece I need to the puzzle. And oftentimes I am grabbing that one Dragonlord Atarka Daryl, but I've never found myself wanting more than one because it seems to like just win the game when it comes out. And I've got another, like, I've got a lot of other things in the deck that do stuff, that I can grab when, you know, I've already got my Dragonlord in play or in my yard or whatever, but...
I figured the second one would come out of the sideboard. I figured there'd be more matchups where the second one was better than, like, the first Hornet Queen or something.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. I mean, the sideboard's pretty tight, and that's something I'll talk about, too.
Yeah, that's why I just wanted to ask. I figured that the second one would be in the sideboard, and I was kind of surprised not to see it.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those cards, though. There's a lot of situations where it's not the greatest thing in the world, so I like it as a one-of. I think it's a great utility card for when it's late in the game and you need a specific thing to break the stall, like you were saying, Corey, and you can tap all the creatures and that sort of thing. And then you just have tons of inherent value with Whip and with Farika and everything else going on.
Yeah, and it doesn't interact with a lot of the control decks, obviously. I mean, besides being a big beater, but they've all got hexproof, you know, like it's a fine card, but it's not.
I just figured out the combo, by the way.
Yeah, what's the combo?
The whip with Torrent Elemental.
Yeah, thing? Yeah, that's it's busted as hell. Yeah.
I just figured that out. I'm like, oh
yeah,
that's really good. Yeah,
I mean, this deck.
Sorry to be slow to the party, but that was like really cool when I figured it out. Sorry.
No, welcome aboard. It's a good party. This deck is good, man. I Brad Nelson did an article a couple months back about like a matchup sheet, and he had all these decks listed, and this one always had a lot of positive matchups, and it's one of the most challenging decks to play against in a tournament. It's just super grindy, and sometimes you get really awkward mana dork draws with like Wayfinder and Karatid and all that, but like other than that, I mean, this is value town city, and
this deck seems sick. I love it.
Corey, did you see the article Ross Merriam had out last week about... It was literally called Beating Esper, and it was about this deck.
Oh, was it really?
No, yeah, I did but not. His version was the other one that you mentioned, though.
The Death Miss.
Yeah, the package, yeah. But it's still, I mean, like, this deck has, you know, so much grind potential that you have all the answers for anything Esper's pretty much going to play.
Right, yeah, it's got a good matchup against Esper, mostly because it's got so much, like, it packs so much punch. Like, the value per card is just so high. Your top decks are, like, Sidisi or Tauren Elemental or Sidisi, Undead Vizier, or Dragon Lord, you know. And so any one of those guys, even if like, I can't steal one of their dragons with the Dragon Lord Silumgar, it's still a beater, you know. Like, to play a 6-mana 3/5 with flying and death touch is fine when, you know, it's not a, you know, not another Elvish Mystic or something. But the sideboard gives me access to a lot of stuff too, because the colors, you know, like I've got all the control options. I'm running two main deck Thoughtseize and two Duress in the sideboard, and I've got, I used to have four Thoughtseize between the main and sideboard, but I like the Duress versus like a Tarka Red, because I don't want to be taking that two damage from Thoughtseize.
Yeah, that's definitely a big help for sure. I mean, that's one of the things actually Mariam has similar in those numbers to you too, and that's one of the things that when we were testing a lot last week, Thoughtseize and Duress, you know, seem to be kind of the go-to plan for a lot of these decks. But like you said too, Duress being relevant against red, it for sure is. It's a nice extra that you can bring in with whatever else you were planning to.
Yeah, so that's the biggest, I mean, that's the biggest, that's the worst matchup from my estimation, is the really aggro-y decks. And it's still beatable. I think it's about, like, it feels like 50%. And it has to do with who goes first too, you know?
Yep.
And because I can get draws where I'm getting a lot of tapped lands and like a lot of Seder Way Finders where I'm just really slow to start. And then I'm oftentimes relying on like a Sidisi Brood Tyrant getting a creature to block and like just die. And so that's not a good situation to be in. The whip is slow, you know, like the life gain is great against an aggro deck, but you've got to have a creature out to block or to attack to gain the life. And you're not going to put 8 mana into it right away to get an activation out of it.
Yeah, you don't have a lot of like early interaction, but at least like you have Wayfinder and Karatid, which are roadblocks that they don't want to see. So it'll kind of it is definitely draw dependent, I feel like, and you know, hopefully you can stick a whip and have it be relevant in time, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I can get turn three Tassigar pretty consistently though with Seder Wayfinders in there, which is pretty great. He's a good blocker.
Oh, for sure. I think like the hardest part for this deck usually is just that it loses to itself more than anything. Like when I'm playing mono red against this deck, like I'm not super happy about that matchup most of the time, just because you have a ton of stuff to get in the way. Like you said, Tassigar and all the little dorks, and like now you have Den Protector and stuff. I mean, you got a lot of stuff that you can just slap down until you get to a clearly superior end game that involves life gain.
Yeah. A lot of the sideboard gives you options for like Drown and Soar. I've got two Drown and Soar on the sideboard, two Bioblight, two Doomwake Giant, and then one Silmgar Drifting Death in the board, or in the main deck, I should say. So like the tokens matchups, and I guess in some ways, some of those red brews where there are a lot of like one drop creatures, like those are fine. In fact, like I'm kind of thinking I have too much of that stuff, and I'm going to take some of the Drown and Soar that are the sideboard in favor of maybe like Negate or something along those lines.
I would say just taking out the Doomwake Giants. Like,
yeah. I think your list is probably all right, man. Mariam's list is really close to your sideboard wise. Like similar numbers with Doomwake and Drown and all that stuff.
Yeah, I was just thinking if you think you have too much for the creature matchup, for the red creature matchup,
yeah,
it'd probably be Doomwake Giant, because you're less likely to like get to five and cast Doomwake Giant, just because how fast the red deck is. Mm-hmm. And Doomwake Giant still doesn't kill Goblin Rabble Master.
What you could do too is like if you're gonna cut one of those, you could pop in maybe another Disdainful Stroke and enhance the control matchup a little bit. Because that card is also just good against, you know, like mid range Abzan and a decent number of other decks that
That's what I was thinking too, John. It was either Negate or Disdainful Stroke, one of those control cards.
Or another
Oh,
go ahead.
Den Protector interacts with that pretty well, too. When I've got him morphed, I can flip him up, grab a Disdainful Stroke from the yard, counter a spell, or grab a Negate from the yard, counter a spell. And sometimes I even find myself tutoring for a Negate or Disdainful Stroke with a Sidisi when I've got like good board presence and I just want to counter like a Crux of Fate or something.
What you might want, I've noticed it pop up in a couple lists. It's in Mariam's, but it was in a few other archetypes this weekend, was Stratus Dancer as like a one or two of, because you can whip it back, you can tutor for it just like the other stuff.
Yeah,
it also mixes up your morphs. I've been playing a couple decks that have a lot of morphs in them, and I feel like that's a really strong point in Standard. If you can confuse your opponent, you know, on what you're going to have underneath there, you can really blow them out in some situations.
Yeah, I'd agree. At first, I was kind of turned off to the whole morph thing and like running Den Protector in there, because when you whip him, he's only a 2/1 that can pretty much be blocked by anything at that point. But the Den Protector gives you so much recursion and so much utility that it's like that card is like meant for this deck. It's so good.
So, like, ideally, you should never ever whip the Den Protector.
Well, I understand, but there are matchups where you just want to get that 2 damage in there.
Sure, corner case scenarios and stuff. I think most of the time you're going to get value out of him, and that's probably why you're seeing him be so strong.
Yeah.
And you're right, I think he is kind of made for a deck like this. I mean, he's good in everything, but he's exceptionally good here when all of your targets are, like, insane. Yeah. Do you have... I'm looking over your list. Oh, you do have 2 Tassiger in there, okay, because you were talking about him.
Yeah, he's in there.
He's strong.
Like I said, it's kind of like an ADH deck. There's a lot of one-offs, so...
Yeah, the Banana Man, taking it home.
The Banana Man. I also have his Dragon Master, who wears him as a necklace in the same deck. So they try to get along, but it's still awkward between them. Oh, yeah, by the way, John, this is a red deck, according to the one Dragon Lord of Tarka. So if you want to do a deck tech on your red deck podcast, just give me a call, man.
Tarka is, man, that card is so good. I don't blame anybody for splashing a little bit to get him in, because I still think him and Dromoka's Command are the 2 best cards in this format. I'm just waiting for some Naya deck with like 3 or 4 of each of those to just smash everything.
Yeah.
I had him in draft the other day.
That's fair. Yeah.
It was so gross. I went explosive vegetation on turn 4 multiple games into a Tarka.
Yeah, that's an easy life.
Playing some EDH.
Yep. All right.
So I got the FNM promo on Friday, and it's a suspension field, which it looks cool.
Yeah, it was
cool,
the worst
promo
ever.
Put in tiny leaders or something.
The hottest of garbage, please.
You know what the next one is, though, right?
Well, what is the next one? I know what the July one is.
Hot Path to Exile action.
No, that's July. So that was my next. That's where I was going with this. Is July is the modern stuff? What's May though?
Who cares?
All right,
probably grounded.
Bunch of chaff in the meantime.
Grounded.
I would go every week if it was grounded. I think it'd be awesome. I was sending out wedding invitations, or putting my wedding invitations together the other day, and I put a couple groundeds in there. So.
Oh, you're
too. Anyway, so that's what I think we should talk about next is the modern FNM promos, which it's very exciting to have Path to Exile joining the mix there. They said that the next 2, though, July and August, are going to both be modern, but they haven't announced what August is yet, so that's kind of open to speculation.
Ooh la la. Yeah. I'm interested.
I like it. The art looks sick on Path to Exile.
Yeah, some people don't like it, but I like it. I think it's cool.
I just prefer my Path to Exile to look like Chuck Norris standing in a field and gaining my opponent's life instead of giving them lands.
Oh, the legacy lover.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is him on the last episode of Walker, Texas Ranger, Daryl.
Yeah, I suppose.
He's going out into the world.
Yep.
You guys know for that show that all the bad guys had to be less than his height?
Yeah.
So you kick him in the face.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that Conan used to have that button he could push.
Yeah,
where would Walker Texas Ranger clip would come on? Yeah.
Yes, perfect.
So, all right, so what do you guys think for August? Some people have been talking about Remand. I don't think it's going to be Remand. That was already an FNM promo, wasn't it?
I don't know. I mean, Path to Exile was already a promo too, so
I don't think you'll see something that's like $10 or $15 like that.
Yeah. Well, it could likely be like Inquisition of Kozilek, Tech Edge, Ghost Quarter.
Could be something like that. Yeah.
Tech Edge was already one, but I think you'll see something in the $4 to $5 range that like holds down a lot of decks and like I don't know. It's like you could see Serum Visions being the one.
Yeah, that's a common though. Do they do commons?
Gitaxian Probe was a common.
Yeah, that's true. It could be Serum Visions. I'm thinking that's going to be in Modern Masters too, but maybe
factor. They could do both.
Probably will be a blue card, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
is it going to be a card that goes in the same deck as Path to Exile, though? That's my question.
Probably. I mean, well, Path to Exile is so splashable that it could be
a universal card.
Deck. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've already had Tidehollow Scholar. We've already had Lingering Souls.
Which was a sick part.
Usually they follow up a good FNM promo with a pile of poop, so I'm guessing it'll probably not be
that. Oh, perfect. So we're talking about, like, literally, like, Warren Instigator or something ridiculous like that. Perfect.
Yeah, Warren Instigator. There you go.
Yeah, because that card sees play.
Yeah, exactly. It's your pile of poop.
Right.
Well, so
are we going to talk about Brando stuff here? Or what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, he didn't show up, so...
Yeah,
he is.
I don't know what he means by this. Can you guys interpret his notes?
Yeah, no. All right, no. How about we Daryl it up here?
I mean, I can because I know what he's talking about because we're all there's a group of us going to an SDG Invitational, and he wants to talk about different stuff for it. But, like, yeah, we'll skip it.
We'll skip it. We'll get him next week.
Yeah, we'll leave it on for next week.
All right.
So I just saw all kinds of interesting, like, corner case stuff around the internet. It wasn't like, oh my god, I want to talk about this legacy thing and this modern thing. There's just kind of some neat decks I saw. I'm going to go through the decks I saw, and then I have like a discussion that we'll kind of double back to. The first thing I saw was kind of linking back to the RPTQ thing. Michael Flores is a psychopath. He lives in New York, and there's probably a RPTQ like three blocks from his apartment. And he paid $600 to fly to New Mexico and play an RPTQ. And he played probably the most absurd-looking deck in the world. It'll be in the show notes. It's five-color blue dragons.
Yeah, that deck's so dumb.
So it leans on Haven and Crucible of the Spirit Dragon as eight lands that make any color mana for dragons. Haven is obviously the big standout for the Pro Tour. You know, you can pick your dragons back up. You can make one mana of any color for your dragons, or you can make colorless. Crucible is make a colorless or a storage land. So tap one and tap it. Put a charge counter on it. Tap it and remove X charge counters to make X mana of any color for dragon spells. To play his dragons, he's got one Atarka, three Dromoka, three Ojutai, a Dragonlord Silumgar, and two Icefall Regents. And then all of his spells are blue, except for an Ugin. Two Anticipate, three Dig, a Disdainful Stroke, four Dissolve, a Dragonlord's Prerogative, two Nullify, two Encase in Ice, two Perilous Vault, four Silumgar Scorn, a Voyage's End, and then 27 lands, the eight Dragon lands, five Islands, four Fetch lands, Polluted Delta, two, and then 10 Temples of various colors and kinds that include blue.
Yeah, why Voyage's End?
It was like a bounce spell that gave me some tempo against mono red. It scryed one, so it fixed your draw a little bit. He hated that card. He wanted to get rid of it.
Okay,
The Voyage's End. It's a unsummoned.
Oh yeah, the bounce spell. Yeah,
yeah. And then his sideboard, and we'll go back to that thought you had real quick. Sideboard's a Disdainful Stroke, one Dragonlord Atarka, one Dragonlord Silumgar, a Dragonlord's Prerogative, and Encase in Ice, four Master of Waves, a Negate, four Omen Speaker, and a Silumgar of the Drifting Death.
Master of Waves?
Four Master of Waves. So yeah. He may or may not have wanted to beat Mono Red with four Omen Speaker.
Four Master? Oh, this is a different deck list.
No, it's the same list.
Yeah, there's one on the bottom.
In his article, he's got a ton of them here. All right,
oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. It's the one he played. Sorry.
So Master of Waves is going to get him one blue pip for the Encase in Ices and one blue for itself, and then potentially some Icefall Regent blue symbols, too.
No, it's more like Omen Speaker blue symbols. He boards in the Master of Waves and the Omen Speakers against Mono Red. Like, that's an 8-card package that comes in against Mono Red.
Sure, and he's got enough here that usually he'll get, like, at least two tokens out of it. But I think we need to talk about a couple of the obvious things with this situation here.
He paid
$600 for a plane ticket.
Yep,
he played in a 37-person RPTQ. And is this list even any good?
Yeah, this is the thing I wanted to bring up. Like, top forward this deal, got to the Pro Tour. Is this a deck? Is he a lucky SOB? Is he just so much better at this game that none of us have a clue? And this is just, like, the best deck ever. Like, things he said in his article that he hated. He never wanted to draw the card Anticipate and boarded it out in every match. He hated the card Dig Through Time and boarded some number of it out in every match, and would have just rather had like Jace's Ingenuity or Dragonlord's Prerogative. And he hated the one Voyage's End.
Sure, yeah. And Voyage's End is a draft card, so that's natural. The Anticipate thing I can get behind because I played a lot of Jeskai with Anticipate, and it was the same feeling for me. I wanted to take it out. I saw some other artists talking about how it's a trap, like it just doesn't do enough, and then you just want a better card instead. But, yeah, he's got, like, I don't know. I mean, this list, I've heard a lot of buzz for this list. People are talking about it. Obviously, it's a different list, and that's one reason. But, like, it does have some numbers that look appealing. I mean, the four Dissolves, the four Scorn. People have said it's very good against Esper.
Yeah.
Dragonlord Jamoka, is that card good?
That card's insane. So
yeah. It's a weird card. It can be really insane, like you're saying, Darryl.
Imagine playing against Mono Red, and you stabilize the board with a couple counterspells and like 10 life. And then you tap out on your turn for 5/7 lifelink flyer and pass.
All right.
How does your opponent ever beat that card?
Yeah, anytime I played against it with mono red, if they've gotten it down, I've lost. Like, there's just no way to beat it once it's down, pretty much. I mean, unless you have some real, like, shenanigans trick, like a harness by force or something like that.
It's also very good in the control mirrors because it can't be countered. And your opponents can't play on your turn. They have to do everything at sorcery speed.
So that's where I wonder if it's really that good. Because, I mean, those abilities are tacked in there and they look like, sure, anti-control. But you can still just Heroes Downfall it during your turn or Foul Tongue or any of those other removal spells. So I wonder if it's just the threshold of goblins or dragons and that's why he played three of them here.
No, the reason he played three of them was for the mono-red matchup. Because just 5/7 lifelink flyer was good enough. Yeah. To beat mono red most of the time.
But he has no way to ramp into it, though.
Right, but he's trying to use, like, that's why he said his, like, mono red matchup game one is really bad, and that's why he has so much in the board for it, with the four Master Waves and four Omen Speakers and the Negate and the Encasing Ice. So he brings in 10 or 11 cards against mono red.
I'm kind of curious, I didn't read through the whole article yet, but I kind of do want to now. I wonder if he brought in Master Waves against other decks, too, just for value and whatnot.
I could see that happening. But yeah, he just, Master of Waves is just like the mono red plan, like, here's a 2/1 pro your deck, go. Like, this guy's a brick wall.
I think what really looks super scary about this deck is that I can imagine some openers where you're like, Scorn or Nullify, you know, some kind of 2-drop in your deck, and then, you know, Dissolve, what have you. And then you just start playing 5 and 6 mana dragons. I mean, like, I can't imagine most decks coming back from Dragonlord Ojutai into Dragonlord Dromoka.
Yeah, like, the deck, I feel like, has some powerful things it's doing, but I think it needs a little more at the bottom end to keep it alive. I think 10 counterspells is a lot, but I think against, like, some decks, the first 2 threats, if it's, like, a mono-red deck and you're on the draw, or the first threat against, like, the first Fleecemane Lion will go unchecked, and you'll have some problems beating it. Like, I think the 5... bad draw spells like the Dig Through Times and the Anticipates can probably get cut just because they don't do enough. Like, he has plenty of lands. I think you might kick Dragonlord's Prerogative up to 3 because you're playing so many dragons that you just have uncounterable draw force.
Yeah, for Brandon.
Yeah. Well, no, it's actually, I think, just fits the deck in general. Like,
Dig is still really good. I don't think you cut Dig here.
Well, he said the problem with it is that he never got enough cards in his graveyard to cast.
Sure.
It.
He doesn't have enough early interaction and stuff, but
yeah. So he said he would just rather not play this card and like play like more Dragonlord's Prerogative or something similar.
So how many times do you draw an opener with 2 Crucible of Spirit Dragon, 2 Hand of Spirit
Dragon? Yeah, I was
wondering
about that.
2 Dissolve, a Nullify. How many cards is that? Is that 6?
That's 7. You got to 7.
All right, that's it.
Got to 7.
Replace any of those cards with Silmgar Scorned, any other double blue.
Yeah, any other spell, yeah.
Well, the weird thing about that, he wants to cut Anticipate, yet if you have those hands, you got to use Anticipate to get to that other blue source.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's... But I think the deck is not that great. Like, I like the dragons thing that he's trying to do. I like what's, like, some of what's going on here, but I think he needs to have, like, some removal spells in his deck, just to be fair. I think if you take this deck and you optimize it, it normalizes to Esper Dragons.
Daryl, he does have removal. He's got Voyage's End.
Okay, we're done.
Combo with Counterspell. Hey, right, we talked, but he's going to win the Pro Tour with this deck, and we're going to be all sad.
Right.
Yep, you got it, Michael Flores. You're the best. Like,
so
think the deck's good.
So what is this? He played in it was a 6-round tournament. He ID'd in the last round and played 1 round.
Yeah.
Top 8 against his best matchup. I mean, it's interesting. It's definitely like super FNM hero deck. Play all the dragons.
Yeah, I don't think it's a deck.
Could be a good choice for like next weekend though. If people are still like stuck on this Esper thing.
I don't know how good the Esper Dragons matchup is for this deck. I'd have to like actually play with it a lot.
I'd be more curious to see how the Abzan matchup is. If the Abzan aggro matchup is reasonable with this deck, I kind of would be comfortable with this because of the fact that he's so skewed against mono red and Esper, and those decks are, you know, pretty relevant axes in this format. It just really depends on how he does in the middle of the road, I think.
Yeah.
Or something like Green Red Dragons, which got second place at the Open, which is still a scary deck.
I'm not impressed by this deck I will give him my Michaela Maroney face and move on.
Right. I definitely don't know what he's doing with the sideboard here, though. That's just the last point here with, like, the two extra dragons.
Three extra dragons. There's just Silumbar the Drifting Death, too.
Oh, yeah.
You missed that one.
That one I can understand because it's relevant in a lot of matchups, but the other two?
Dragonlord Silumbar is actually really good in most of the mid-range matchups because you just take their permanent. You're just like, your best permanent is my permanent. Thank you. Like,
yeah, but when I've played Control, I've seen that thing take over too, but it always looks win more on camera. And every time I've played with it, like, you just, like, I don't know, it's like the one dragon you have in your deck that actually can eat a removal spell. So it just seems like, so unless, like, you're in the perfect situation, it's gonna die.
In all honesty, it's like your best answer to Ugin in your mono blue deck.
Your best answer, like, to what?
Opponent, to Ugin. Like, if your opponent plays Ugin and bolts you, you place Dragonlord Silumbar, take their Ugin, and ultimate it.
Yeah, that's a great thing to do with it, but the alternative is you steal their creature, and then your Dragonlord Silumbar gets killed when you go to block. I always feel really crappy when I tap out for that thing and it gets killed, which happens almost every time.
Although that Ugin play is pretty sexy. That might be enough reason to play it. I don't know.
Yeah, like, if your opponent is Uginning and they just, like, play it and hit you because you haven't played anything, it could get really ugly. Like,
but isn't Negate just a better answer to Ugin than a Dragonlord Silumbar?
So you don't have an answer when it gets on the table is the problem.
Well, then, like, don't tap out. When they're up to 8 mana, like, they're going to play an Ugin, you can see it coming.
Yeah, really? Yeah. But no, I just don't like the deck. I think it's cute. I think it was good for a weekend. I don't think this is the deck I want to be playing moving forward.
All right. Yeah.
Other sweet deck I saw, Green White Trap from the Invitational or from the Premier IQ.
Yeah, I saw that too.
The Star City Games one this weekend. I'm a huge fan of how ridiculous this deck is, by the way.
And note, folks, this is a modern deck.
That's the modern deck. I was about to go through the list. 4 Birds of Paradise, 4 Knight of the Reliquary, 3 Lotus Cobra, 4 Nest Invader, 4 Noble Hierarch, 4 Primeval Titan, 4 Emrakul the Aeon's Torn, a Dryad Arbor, a myriad of lands, including 2 Mosswort Bridge, and 4 Windrisk Heights. The rest of them are make mana, and there's a couple man lands. 4 Summoning Trap, 4 Lingering Souls, and then the sideboard is pretty simple. 4 Thalia, 4 Obstinate Baeloth, 3 Path, 2 Creeping Corrosion, and 2 Wall of Reverence. For those of you that don't know that one, that's a 1/6 defender. At the beginning of your next end step, you may gain life equal, or the beginning of your end step, you may gain life equal to the power of target creature you control.
And it has flying.
It does have flying and defender, correct. So this deck is just like trying to put Emrakul into play in the most ridiculous ways. Like, play my 3-drop.
Oh, I did not even see Emrakul in this list.
Yeah, there are 4 Emrakuls in this deck. Yeah, welcome to the party. So you're trying to put Emrakul into play in the most absurd ways possible. You're going, like, birds into Windrisk Heights, tap, put Emrakul underneath it, play Nest Invader, untap, attack with my 3 creatures, Windrisk Heights my Emrakul, take an extra turn, untap, kill you. You're using Summoning Trap to power Windrisk Heights. You have Mosswort Bridge, which is the hideaway land that's green, whose condition is if you have 10 or more power, put the card into play. So you have Summoning Trap for Primeval Titan to go get your hideaway lands to put cards underneath them and to power up your Mosswort Bridge. Like, you have a lot of weird lines in this deck. And sometimes you just end a turn Summoning Trap at Emrakul, and they're dead. So.
I don't know why you'd play this list over, like, a Bloom Titan list. I mean, I guess you get a little bit of an aggro plan going on here, too.
Yeah, you have, like, the early aggro plan. You have a Gavinny Township. I think you'd probably want another Gavinny Township.
That's a line, too. There are 2 win conditions. I mean, that's a very viable way to just, like, go to town, mid-range, right, aggro, tokens.
So, like, but honestly, like, a lot of times you'll play, like, a turn 2 Lotus Cobra. Your opponent will spell snare it, and you'll play Summoning Trap and put an Emrakul in the play.
Yeah, that's got to feel like the best feeling. Like, you're playing against twins.
Or you'll put a Primeval Titan into play and go get 2 lands, and they're dead.
Yeah. I like the Nest Invader in here. That seems kind of cute with Gavinny, but also you can activate the Windswept, or no, the Windrisk Heights by attacking with 3 creatures.
That's the whole thing for Nest Invader there is to power up the Windrisk Heights.
Yeah, I didn't even see that interaction. That seems legit.
Yes, it makes an 0-1 that you can attack with.
Windrush Kites is a really good card, too. I think people, like, forget. That card is extremely good value.
That card is terrifying.
I've played a number of extended tournaments. I used to have a red-white deck that I used to play, and that card was just single-handedly beat any kind of aggro deck, especially with this.
Let me tell you how terrifying that card is. I played a lot of control in that format, surprise. And I was playing like a 5-pillar control deck, and my opponent had like 3 Spectral Procession tokens and a Windrush Heights. And I was like, all right, I'm good. I'm going to tap out for this Broodmate Dragon. I'm going to make 2/4/4s. They're going to attack with their 3/1/1s and put like an Anthem into play, and I'm fine. And I had like a couple of, like, I had like a Cruel Ultimatum and a couple of like removal spells in my hand. And I was like, all right, and a Mull Drifter. I was like, all right, I'm going to crush this guy. No big deal. My opponent attacks me with 3 creatures. We go to blocks, and he activates his Windrush Kites and Identity Crisis me. And I about threw the table over in disgust.
That was the best card.
That was horrifying. And then he like killed my 2 dragons, and I had stone nothing against 3/1/1s. And I was just like, well, that's horrible. That sounds like one of the
best possible things you could have under a Windrush Kites. That card was such a beating.
That card was terrifying. But yeah, so I've had that happen to me multiple times in tournament settings. So I don't want to relive Windrush Kites. So
I like how this guy, like, not only does he have like some aggro going on here, but like it seems very easy to get a turn 2 Lingering Souls, which that's pretty hard to beat even in Modern. Like Lingering Souls is still really good.
So you can actually on turn 3 get a Lingering Souls and flash it back with Lotus Cobra.
Oh my.
Like, Lotus Cobra fetch land. Because you have 2 mana, you go fetch land, add a mana, break it, add a mana, put a land into play, 3 mana, 5 mana, Lingering Souls, flash it back. So that's also a line that you have, that you and then attack them with your Lotus Cobra. So you have 6 power in play.
Yeah, and that against the fair decks, like most fair decks can't handle that.
Yeah. So I mean there's
Did you talk about the Knight of the Reliquary tech with the like Mosswort Bridge, Windrush Kites stuff?
I touched on it with Primeval Titan. Knight of the Reliquary sort of works the same way as Primeval Titan. It's a smaller.
I love how like you can do that at instant speed too. It's like at the end of their turn, they pass. Oh, you fetch out a Mosswort Bridge or Windrush Kites, and then next turn you're going at it.
That's so degenerate.
Like a lot of the time with Knight of the Reliquary, it'll probably be Mosswort Bridge because your Knight of the Reliquary will probably be a 10/10.
Oh yeah.
And so you'll just like, oh, I have a 10/10. Activate with Mosswort Bridge. Put an Emrakul into play. Attack you. Untap 25 you. You know,
not to say that you're always going to have an Emrakul in the top 4, but you've got 4 prime times.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you have a bunch of big idiots.
All right, I'm completely sold on this. If we do another leg day, I want to play this deck in Modern.
Do you have your 4 Emrakuls?
I have none of these cards, but this is so pretty.
But yeah, like I like the mono red sideboard with the 4 option to bail out 2 Wall of Reverence. Because a lot of times you'll just put a Wall of Reverence into play and you'll gain a life because Mono Red can never kill this thing. And then you'll like put a Primeval Titan into play and gain 6 life, and your Mono Red opponent just wants to rip their hair out. Because they have a 1/6 and a 6/6 they have to beat, and you're gaining 6 life per turn if they can't kill both of them. So they have to spend so many spells just to get a Wall of Reverence off the table. It's insane.
I just want to race Tron with this deck and just like laugh at them when they play their Wormcoil Engine and then I play an Emrakul.
I mean, I think it's probably just fun to play this deck against like the fair blue decks when you just play a 2-drop and they spell snare it and you summoning trap and put a Knight of the Reliquary into play. Like, I think that's gotta feel pretty good.
Yep. Oh yeah.
Yeah. But I've said enough on this deck. I love it. It's awesome. I'm ready to move to my discussion point if you guys are ready to.
Yes. Via Reddit.
All right, yeah. So the Reddits. Everybody loves the Reddits. This was actually something I thought that was kind of interesting. It was something that kind of developed on Twitter between like Cedric Phillips and Brian Kibler, and you know other people kind of joined in. I saw some tweets from Martin Juza about systematic scouting at Pro Tours. And there's a big block of text that you can read, and there's a ton of Reddit comments and stuff like that. But I'll give you the TLDR of the Reddit thread. I kind of read through a bunch of it. It's basically that big teams have very systematic scouting. They'll see a person, they'll go to their Google Drive, and they'll update the Google Drive spreadsheet with the person's name and what they're playing on their smartphone. So, like, Team Channel Fireball has, like, 20 guys on it. And all of them will be updating the Team Channel Fireball scouting spreadsheet. You know, here's the name, here's what they were playing. And so by, like, the end of round 7, you can, like, pull up, like, go see your pairing, pull up your Google Drive spreadsheet, type the person's name in and go, oh, hey, it's John Galley. He's playing mono red. Sweet. I know what hands to keep. And like, go sit down and play against John Galley with an extreme advantage because you know what John Galley's playing. So they're talking about sort of the legality, how questionable it is. Can it be banned? Is there something we can do about it? What are the pros and cons? How can we counteract it as the community? You know, what's going on here? How do we kind of make it frowned upon to do
something? I think this is sweet, dude. This is some, like, Bill Belichick level business.
Yeah, this is some for real Bill Belichick level business. But like, they were trying to figure out, is there something we can do? And I saw some interesting ideas on it. The first idea was crowdsourced scouting. So basically what you're saying is, hey, you, like John Galley, you and I and anybody else that will join in with us, we're going to put all of our deck archetypes on a spreadsheet. And all of us are going to update this spreadsheet. And so if you agree to give your deck archetype to the spreadsheet, we'll put all the other people we play against deck archetypes. And it's basically like crowdsource scouting against the big teams. So that you have, you know, 100 people doing it instead of 20, and you build up the whole tournament with the spreadsheets by the time you get to, like, round 4. So you know what everyone's playing.
So basically, you can't fight it. We got to just encourage it. Everyone's got access to it.
That's one thought. The second thought is, you know, why don't we just distribute the deck lists at the beginning of round 2? Why don't I just...
Yeah, but surprise is such a big element, you know?
Correct. And this is an argument.
I think that takes away from it, you know? I mean, obviously anything does, any solution, but...
Yeah, this is certainly an argument that came up, is that surprise is a huge element, so we can't take away from it. So I kind of want to hear what your guys' thoughts are. I kind of personally like the crowdsourcing idea, but there's no way we can ban it, because, you know, you can't prevent... So we ban smartphones.
There will be a full Amish.
Yeah, there'll be a guy walking around with a tablet chiseling it into it, and he'll pull out the gigantic stone tablet for Channel Fireball and say, "Doth play Luis Scott Vargas on Dragons," or whatever. You know, so I don't think we can ban it.
I think one of the unfortunate things,
well,
too.
I don't know. What do you guys think about it? Like, it's obviously a thing that's happening. You know?
I mean, the Pro Tour just started letting, like, spectators, you know, see the matches and stuff and come to the Pro Tour. I mean, that's one of the things I'm looking forward to in Milwaukee. So, like, that part is unfortunate, because if this is all going down, you got to imagine most of the solutions are going to be less spectatorship, or, you know, you have to be cleared or something, or, you know, I don't know. There's going to be different things probably going on, but I don't know how you stop the internet, you know?
Can't stop the internet.
The internet will take us over.
It's bigger than all of us.
If people are going to pop this on a Google Drive, you're not going to stop that. You know, we learned from the Napster days, and sorry, I'm probably getting really old for some of our listeners
here.
No,
I'm with you. Go ahead.
But, you know, the days of downloading music and the government trying to stop it and just not happening.
Yeah, you should ask Brandon about Napster. He got busted for that.
He got busted for Napster?
Yeah, he got he had like a $3,000 settlement or something. I'll let him tell the story when he returns.
What? Oh, man, this has to go on the cast.
Speaking of Brandon, I just got word from him that he is homesick. He passed out after work, and he's not making it. So everybody, keep him in your thoughts while he's in Chicago at the Cubs game and singing Twist and Shout in the parade today.
Yeah, RIP the dream. Thank you for your
fuel. He smoked way too much of his Mark Twain, man. I think that's what it is.
That's right.
But yeah, Corey, I'd like to hear your thoughts. What do you think about the systematic scouting thing? Like,
I don't think you can fight it, man. You can't enforce a no smartphone rule at a tournament like that. And if it's a thing, I mean, I think the crowdsourcing is really the only way around it. And you can only be so accurate, right? Because you base it off of what you see, right? These pros are not, like, posting their deck lists on the day of the Pro Tour on purpose, right? They're doing it a couple of days after when they do their report. But they don't want to give away their tech. And it's all, like, part of this big secret. So all of that information is coming from what their opponents have faced, right?
Yeah.
So they still have some tricks in their bag, you know? Like, I think that's part of it. And that's kind of, like, what makes the team aspect interesting. Other than those guys are testing with each other and all that. But I don't know. I mean, I think we can adapt to it. I think we can get used to that, and I think that can just become a part of, you know, what we do. Technology is already so embedded in this game. Like, the fact that deck lists are so accessible and people are going online and getting their playable cards from deck lists, and they're in, even like brews, like are informed by what other people are running in their decks. You know, it's like so much of it is already crowdsourced, and so much of the ideas that people are using are taken from other people's ideas and taken from the hive mind that is the MTG community online, you know?
Maybe that wouldn't make it such a bad thing for everybody then to have the information at this point. I mean, we moved forward so much with that where, like you said, Corey, I mean, the decks are everywhere online that, you know, and people can piece stuff together from coverage. I've done that a number of times. Maybe we're at the point where everything should be public. And, yeah, the surprise factor's gone, but you solve an issue like this and... You know, this is supposed to be a tournament about talent and play skill, you know, not, and your matchups that are bad are not going to be, like, abysmal anyways, so just play, you know, your best magic with it.
Right, and I will say that one argument that came up is they don't want to give out deck lists to protect the tech because Magic is a game of incomplete information, and not having a complete information on your opponent's deck list is a big deal. But, like, it comes to me that, like, some pros will go so far into the tank and play around like, oh, he's playing an Abzan Controllers deck. He might have a Dune Blast because he thinks Dune Blast does something in these matchups. So I'm going to play around Dune Blast, even though, like, normally you wouldn't play around that card. Whereas, like, if you look at your opponent's deck list and go, oh, it doesn't have a Dune Blast, do the thing I'm going to do. Like, so, I mean, like, some pros will play around that. But yeah. A lot of the solutions are, like, so obvious that it's like, oh, I have a board position that I'm ahead in, and I shouldn't play around, like, I should play around a Wrath of God. Well, I'm certainly playing around Doomblast by playing around Wrath of God, so I'll just do nothing and pass. So, like, a lot of it, I think, there's still a ton of hidden information when two people are interacting in a game of Magic the Gathering. Like, there's still a hand that's unknown, there's still a deck that's unknown, you don't know what order the cards can come off your opponent's deck, unless they just want to give you that information from Corsair, you know, stuff like that, so you don't know all the information anyways. And if, you know, your opponent and you combine to create a situation where you have perfect information because you've thought sees them and they've played a Corsair and you know all their cards and they've just revealed every one of their draws to you, then we get into a situation where you're not playing a game with perfect information, but you can create that kind of the illusion, so to speak, is what they're saying, that the illusion of imperfect information still hangs around. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that if, you know, some people are going to have access to all of the information because of their team size, everyone should be on a fair playing field with all of the information. Let the game itself be a game of imperfect information.
Well, you still gotta see the cards, though, too. I mean, I think even with scouting, you're not going to see all the cards over the course of a game or two, and these Pro Tours are broken up in different formats, you know, so you play three or four games at a time. So even with good scouting, you may not know everything. I mean, it kind of sucks that somebody might know, you know, 55 of your cards or something like that, but I don't know. I mean, maybe you just do leave it up to people who do a better job of it than others or something like that. It's not like some people in this Reddit conversation were comparing it to, I don't know if you heard about this, but the guy who... the chess player who got caught running a program that would solve the turn for him, which this is not the same. You know, I mean, you can know some of their list and still, you know, still get very much outplayed.
Right.
But yeah. I don't know. This is tough, man.
It's like we're becoming the football of competitive board and card games, whereas, like, you know, baseball maintains its roots and is very, like, slow to adapt, like, replay and technology into the game. Like, technology's become such a part of Magic. It's like part of the competition is the research that you do, you know, and, like, what's getting played. Like, to understand the meta, you've got to do research, you know. Like, to be successful, you've got to understand, like, what the trends are with the current deck and you know, like, what people's sideboard plan is. And part of that you get from experience, but the internet, like, accelerates that so much that with all the coverage and all the articles that people are writing and all the podcasts where people are talking about stuff like that, all that information is available to you to take advantage of if you can spend the time and the resources to do it. You know, whether that be buying the premium articles on Star City Games or what, you know.
Well, and that's along that same line. I mean, that's the natural evolution of where this would go anyways. We're gonna have more coverage. We're going to have better coverage, which is going to reveal more information about what's going on in the tournament. So, you know, I don't think the argument against this kind of thing is very strong, because people are going to get that information one way or another. And, you know, what kind of infractions are you going to impose? I mean, it's so hard to prove a lot of this stuff, even if it's well known.
Right, right. Yeah.
But it's an interesting Reddit post, though, Daryl. So did the pros at all, do you know if they commented on Reddit on this?
I don't know if they commented. I didn't see any Reddit comments from the pros, but I know that, like, the pros sort of started the discussion. Cedric Phillips kicked it off, and, like, different pros were chiming in here and there, kind of talking about it and stuff like that.
Well, the other thing they might possibly do is they could go back to the old way where they just don't allow spectators and maybe keep, you know, people who are not involved in the specific matches away from those matches. But I feel like that's a regression, and I don't feel like they would do that.
I agree.
All right. Cool. We got one more thing to do before we wrap up tonight, and that's the deck tech that was promised. Daryl, are you all set with your comments on that? I don't mean to cut you off.
Go ahead, guys. I just wanted to – I kind of commented to start the discussion, and I just wanted to see your guys' opinions on it. Okay. I agree that there are a lot of different ways to handle it, and I don't know if we'll ever find the perfect way to do so.
Okay. Well, Brandon is not here tonight because he's out Ferris Bueller-ing his day off, and he is here in spirit, though, because we made a bumper bit last week for the Juicy Deck Tech segment, so we're going to run that. I'm going to insert that right about here. Though Daryl and John, you are not gonna hear that, unfortunately. Be edited in. Yeah.
I actually listen to our cast, so I'll hear it later.
All right, cool.
Daryl.
Hey, man, I just make the product. I don't want to listen.
Well, it's classic. Yeah, don't drink your supply, Daryl.
Yeah, no way, dude.
So the deck tech was based around restore balance, and I kind of crowdsourced a little bit. I got a few cool deck lists from that. I'm gonna go over the one that the idea was taken from, and that's this red white restore balance deck in modern that a friend of mine in Milwaukee actually came up with. But a lot of these lists, like the ones that you find on MTG Top 8, I'll put those in the show notes as well. Run the whole cascade strategy of getting your restore balance off, cheating your restore balance off with a cascade spell, and having nothing less than 3 CMC in your deck so that restore balance goes off every time you cast a cascade spell. And again, restore balance, by the way, is the 0 cost card that's got spend 6 for 1 white. Each player chooses a number of lands he or she controls equal to the lowest number of lands controlled by the player who controls the fewest, and then sacrifices the rest. Players sacrifice creatures and discard cards in the same way. And so, like, in modern, where there are a whole lot of... Yeah.
If the people don't know what balance is, they shouldn't be listening. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, it's an old vintage card that would get played off a bunch of mocks.
Right, it casts balance. Balance costs 2 mana. This costs 0 mana, but it takes 6 turns, which is the biggest challenge.
Yeah.
So if it goes off, I mean, the deck is positioned well enough to basically get rid of all its useful resources and cause your opponent to be pretty well neutered. And so that's kind of the idea behind the build. But of course, the biggest interaction is between that and Greater Gargadon. I think we talked about this a little bit last week, but just to refresh everyone's memory, Greater Gargadon is a 10 mana 9/7 beast. It's a red and a 9, colorless. And it's suspend 10 for 1 red, which is a lot, but you can sack an artifact, creature, or land to remove a time counter from it. So before restore balance goes off, you're sacrificing a lot of your permanents to the Gargadon, and that way the opponent's gonna have to sack down to like 0 lands, 0 creatures, discard the cards out of their hand, and you're gonna end up with a 9/7 that's got haste because it's suspended. So it's very fragile because the suspend is so like transparent, you know, like it sits on the table for 6 turns before it goes off and they can counter it. But basically, and my friend's name is Max, who came up with this deck. Basically, his idea was that doesn't matter. You know, if like they're in a position where they're going to put a wasted counter spell on that, then the turn is open for you to do other things. And this deck kind of sneaks in Kitchen Finks and what's the angel called? Let's see here. Kitchen Finks and Archangel of Thune combo as well, because with Greater Gargadon suspended, you can have infinite sack outlets for the Kitchen Finks, even once you get him down to 0 suspend,
Oh, that's cute.
And so you can gain infinite life that way and you know, be oh, in that's... there with your dudes.
Wait, that's... how does that work? So you can okay. sack kitchen Darryl, things you to your one. Sack outlets?
Yep, and... I got it. So Greater Gargadon says, let me read the text so you'll understand. So
no,
we're going to have a bunch of trigger mess. Sacrifice an artifact creature and land, colon, do some
oh,
because
you can respond
to
the trigger by sacking it.
You sacrifice, sacrifice and put the remove a counter trigger on the stack, and then it triggers Kitchen Finks. Kitchen Finks persists, so the stack looks like Greater Gargadon sacrifice ability persist trigger. Kitchen Finks comes back to play, you gain 2 life, triggers Archangel of Thune, puts a +1/+1 counter on all your creatures. Kitchen Finks becomes a 3/2 again with no counters on it. You can then do the Gargadon thing again, triggers the Kitchen Finks again, yep. puts the Kitchen
same
Finks
combo on. As that was
yeah.
in like 5.
Same thing as the Malira Pod combo, except your sacrifice outlet is hanging out in exile where no one would think of that to be the thing that's going to happen until you do it and they're like, oh, that's a thing.
So that's kind of the story of this deck, because Max is kind of an old school player. He hasn't been sticking with modern nearly as well as we have. But recently he started playing again. I dragged him along to FNMs, and he kind of put this deck together because he's a very like analytical guy, and he's like all about kind of squeezing in a lot of these kind of cool interactions. And so a lot of the cards in this deck you play them, and the opponent has to read them, which is great because they don't know what's coming. But it's a lot of Nyx Fleece Lamb,
okay,
and a lot of Ghostly Prism.
Somebody's
yeah,
gonna help me.
Go
up
for
here.
It.
What the hell is the Lich's Mirror in the deck for?
Okay,
why?
great question. That's one of those situations.
Never mind. I got it. I figured it out.
So Lich's Mirror is an artifact. It says if you lose the game, instead you shuffle your hand, your graveyard, and all permits you own into your library, then draw 7 cards, and your life total becomes 20. So you Lich's Mirror when you've got the Restore Balance or the suspended Gargadon out, and those things stay suspended while you start your new Lich's Mirror game.
Oh my
yeah.
god.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I mean,
so, there's only one of those in there, but it's pretty sweet.
Can you, like, kill yourself in response to a restore balance so that, like, you draw 7 and then discard, like, half of them and your opponent has, like, literal nothing? Is this a thing we can do?
I don't know if you can kill yourself in that way.
Because that would be pretty sweet. If
you
we,
can
like,
lightning bolt yourself.
Well, like, what if we played, like, a Skull Scout or something?
Pretty
and,
sure, like all game state effects
it.
End when the game ends, though. As cool as that would be.
Yeah.
I like the last list you got on here, the Saffron Olive. That I've been reading that guy's articles a lot recently. He's had some good stuff. I mean, that's more of the traditional, but...
Yeah, I'll post that one as well. I'm going to post the red-white list up as well as the Saffron Olive. And there's one more that we got submitted from a listener on Facebook. So you can check those out if you're interested. There's a lot of cool stuff that goes on in them. You can try them out. There are obviously some tweaks that need to be made to all of these. But the I think the most tried and true one is the Saffron Olive list. And that was, what was this, April 7th, 2015. It wasn't that long ago that he posted this. But this is a budget list.
The slightly budget Restore Balance one is actually pretty sweet. It's got some really nice interactions. He upgraded some cards. He added a couple Blood Moons for the random like turn 2 Blood Moon you. Which is nice, but, you know, we'll kind of discount that.
Where are you seeing Blood Moon?
So if you scroll down, he says, here after his game article, he's like, here's a slightly less budget take, where he adds a couple Blood Moons. But the sweet thing is adding the Tezzeret package.
Yeah, that looks
because, like,
nice.
Turning your random artifact knucklehead into a 5/5 is pretty good. And then if you just have a Tezzeret the Seeker... turning all of your random artifact knuckleheads into 5/5s is also pretty good. So, I mean, you get the kind of 6 of 1, half dozen of the other thing. I think that this deck could probably afford to play more Blood Moons, because I think that card just, like, locks your opponent out of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think 2 is the correct number. I like how both of his lists have March of the Machines, though. That card's just sweet.
Yeah, well, he cut some number of March of the Machines for Tezzeret Agent of Bolas and Tezzeret.
Sure. It probably shouldn't be a 3 of anyways in the list, so I like it as a Mize.
I like the Tezzeret package. I think I just like 2 of each Tezzeret. Because you can play the big Tezzeret and get a border post and still have the ability to, like, untap your border posts to play bigger spells or more Tezzeret or something like that.
Right.
So I think you afford yourself a little flexibility with 2 of each Tezzeret.
So before we go too far, though, we should say that the main, like, source of ramp and everything is these 3-mana border posts in here, and that's kind of what the March of the Machines and Tezzeret operate off of. It's pretty cute. It's an optional, you know, one of the win conditions, because restore balance does not cause you to sacrifice artifacts. You could end up with a bunch of those guys in play. And it also doesn't cause you to sacrifice planeswalkers. Those are the two that kind of dodge the restore balance. So they survive, and they can beat in then after that. These decks are both budget decks, so they're both under like $200 to buy in paper. In fact, no, they're $45 in paper. And of course you can optimize a little bit with some fetch lands and all that, but when this article was posted, it actually caused restore balance to spike, according to one of these this I got from
Saffron's article. Yeah.
Caused restore balance to spike about to $2 from like 35 cents or something like that. So a lot of people are picking up on this one on MTGO, which is pretty great. It seems like a relatively competitive deck for such a cheap price tag.
You shot called it, Corey.
Yeah, I did. Look at that. Well, this was April 7th, so I think this was before we even started talking about it.
Yeah, $1.59 online for restore balance, up from 35 cents after the launch of DTK. And then $1.57 on TCG Player Mid right now.
Yeah. Cool. And then the last one I'm going to post on there was from Cole, I believe, online, who submitted this over Facebook. And this is a more traditional, like, blue-white control deck that runs, like, Geist and Snapcaster and V-Click and stuff. And then just kind of happens to have four restore balance in the deck. So I don't think this one's so much been tested as much as it's just kind of an interesting brew. He's got Narset in here, too, which is kind of cool. So
yeah, no.
Feel free to check that one out.
This deck is bad. I'm not going to get started.
It's kind of cool that he has some value, though. You know, like, he's using it as a value card in control, which is kind of interesting. But
so, like, there's a huge problem with it, and it's that you'll never want to, like, sacrifice your lands. He doesn't play enough, like, Signets to get himself off the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of awkward.
Maybe that could be a potential direction for the deck if he works on it or something.
Right. So that's another. I think those are just like the three examples of the different types of builds you can do with this. Like, obviously, like, just a more traditional control deck is one way to go with it. And then just like kind of happens to have that restore balance that you can just kind of like protect until it goes off. So that's fine. I think that could be a thing. But it's almost like, why don't you just play, you know, American control and modern then in that case? So.
Yep.
All right. Anyway, so that's that. I'll put them on the show notes. Check them out. I would like to hear your experiences with them. If you've got any tweaks or anything, especially for the red-white list, I'd share it with Max and also be interested in hearing it myself. So, yeah, let me know. All right. So I think that brings us to the end here. Even though we were down to three Caballeros tonight, not the four or five typically, we still went to about an hour and a half. So we've got a lot to talk about, and we'll have to... we'll have to get going next week with the Modern Masters spoilers too, so that'll be exciting.
Yeah, boy.
Any non-magic that we can wrap up with before we go?
Any of you guys have trips coming up?
Yeah.
No, I don't have any trips. I have a nice potential interview coming up for a job in Baltimore, Maryland, so keep my fingers crossed for that one, but yeah. We'll see.
I hope you survive.
Ah, that's funny and offensive, but mostly funny.
Well,
no, I'm hoping that it pulls through, Daryl, because that job sounds like a good opportunity.
Yeah,
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, just a casual software job, you know, the usual.
Yeah. Anything pays the bills, you know.
Yeah, anything that pays the bills better than I'm getting paid now, you know.
Yep. I am going to be away from the podcast in a couple weeks here. One of my buddies is getting married down in Atlanta, so I'll be doing a little cross-country drive down there.
Oh, man. Good luck with that, bro.
Yeah, I've never been to the South, so this will be interesting.
So when is the wedding?
Wedding is Friday, May 15th. Okay. We're leaving earlier in the week, and we're doing like a week-long kind of vacation with it. And we're going to, like, stop in Louisville and maybe, like, Memphis and stuff like that on the way back. So
you should pray to whatever god you believe in, because it's going to be 100,000 degrees.
Oh, see, man, that's right up my alley, dude. I am, I love the heat. That's why I hate the state that we live in.
But the thought of 100,000 degrees and full suit.
Yeah, that part's going to be a little rough.
Not exciting.
I'm in the wedding, so I'm definitely going to be suited up.
Yep, gross. Quit.
Kind of gross. I still love the heat, man. Like my wife's more like neutral temps and stuff, so she's okay with Wisconsin. Could use a little warmer, but I will take the the 100 degree, 110 degree.
So love it. You guys doing vests and everything?
Yep.
Cummerbund.
Full deal. And not only is it the full deal, but it is like outside, supposedly in like a swamp type territory, like
Well, that's good.
You know, like a nature preserve type thing. So yeah, it's gonna be.
You guys are gonna take fan boats to the ceremony.
Yeah, I hope the gators get you.
Troll them gators, but.
You'll be surprised at how many gators there really are down there. It's kind of like when you live in the Midwest, you never really actually expect to see alligators when you go in the South. But if you're like by the, if you're by the shore, it's like, I think I saw five alligators when I went to Florida last time, and I was like, this is real life. It's not a myth.
Dude, I just want to meet some real down country folk down there. I want to like eat some chicken waffles and grits on somebody's porch.
Yeah, there you go.
Live the Southern lifestyle.
That sounds perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure the Waffle House or something will get hit up, but, you know.
Of course.
Yeah, well, so that'll be fun, man. I haven't even seen Louisville. Like, I've never been south of, I don't even know, I'm trying to think. I've never been to Tennessee or, like, any of that. Anything south of, like, southern Illinois.
South of the Mason-Dixon?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
All right.
So, be cool.
Well, I'll be gone in June. I'm going on a trip to Canada, Winnipeg.
Nice.
Yeah.
You guys are so exciting.
What are you doing in Winnipeg, man?
This is kind of like a honeymoon that happens before the wedding because it is the Women's World Cup, and my fiance is a really big soccer fan, so we're going to do that. It's kind of sweet. There's like they do a stadium pass, so for like $100, we got tickets to the stadium for a whole week, so we get to go see all the games that take place in that stadium.
It sounds like it'll be a blast.
3 or 4 U.S. games, so I'll do face paint and everything and wear an American flag.
My question is, do you like soccer?
I like soccer. I don't know much about soccer, but I'm sure I'll have a good time. And we're going on a trip.
If you're involved in sports and you're on a trip with your future wife here, that sounds like a blast, dude.
Yeah, I think you're winning. But if you don't like soccer, it sounds miserable. I enjoy soccer.
Wait, so what did you say it's, though? It's some kind of cup?
It's the World Cup. The Women's World Cup.
Oh, the Women's World Cup. Oh, man, yeah. That'll be awesome, dude. The U.S. has been so good recently, too, for
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
They're front-running that one.
Fingers crossed my passport comes in time.
I think if I could, I'm not like a huge soccer guy, but when it comes to the World Cup, like I always end up watching a ton of games. And I think for like the casual sport that you may not be into, that would be like my favorite thing to go see would be like a live soccer event because people just get so into it.
Oh, yeah, they go nuts. Yep.
I fully expect like to see a video of you with like a vuvuzela or something going off.
I was talking to her about that. She told me they're apparently banned from the stadium after the South Africa World Cup.
Yeah, those things are South Africa.
I definitely watch much less soccer that World Cup because of that annoying movie.
So
your TV sounded like a bug got stuck inside the screen or something like that. Yeah.
I mean, you guys sound much more exciting. All I'm doing this weekend is going to gamble.
That sounds better, dude. I don't have any money to gamble. So this trip's sapping like all of our finances plus some. So
wonderful. Yeah.
It's unnecessary.
I think actually we are going to go gamble this weekend in the PPTQ. So
I'm going to just go play blackjack on Friday.
Yeah, for our listeners.
For no fun or profit.
Daryl, I think you should join us in the PPTQ quest. We've got the multiple cars going here.
Where to?
Either Appleton or Stevens Point. So,
Appleton. Oh, God, I have to play standard. I don't know how this format works.
Appleton's the best place to play Magic. Harry Houdini grew up there. He played Magic all his life.
I've only played there once.
So I'm dropping the mic and walking away.
Bad joke. All right.
Wait, I totally missed the joke. What was it again?
It's over.
All right.
No, I played there once, and this girl was working, and she was just super pissed off at having to deal with all the nerds rolling in at like 8 in the morning.
Yeah.
It's not good.
Yeah, well, come on. Her ratio is good. She could pick one guy out.
I don't know exactly.
She had her choices.
5 dates there going on. You know,
all right. But the podcast is dead.
We're devolving. All
right. We've died. The podcast, it's over.
I'm going to actually, before we go, I have an idea for a business venture, and I think you guys might be interested in this. It's a website. I'm going to buy it. Actually, I better GoDaddy this right away so no one else takes it before this gets posted. But howmanytibalt.com.
Oh, my God. You and Tibalt.
So what it's going to be is every time Star City Games, Open List, PTQ List, you know, Pro Tour, any like big tournament results get posted. How many Tybalt.com has simply one sentence on it? This weekend there were blank Tybalt.
Daryl, what is he talking about over here?
And just so you know,
it's too bad Tybalt's not in standard, because I feel like just for this cast, I'd roll with one on my sideboard at a major event. I don't even care.
God, sideboard slots are so valuable,
dude. Some guys used to do that. I remember like one guy top eight at Wisconsin States one year back when it was big, and he had like some super rando card in there, and it was all because it was like a buddy bet him to have it in there and see how he did.
Well, we'll be talking about Tybalt again next week when we do Modern Masters 2 spoilers.
This sounds like the terrible Goblin Charmelter deck that had 15 slivers in sideboard. God, you guys. Can we just end this cast?
Yeah, we can. It's over. It's over. Good night.
It's ogre.
Cue the tight exit music.
All right. Yeah, we'll do Christmas again this week. All right. See you next week. Oh, also, wait, before we go, we got to talk about something. Please, first of all, let us know what you think about this new format, if this is something we should keep going with or go back to the old cut and dry tournament results. Any feedback is good feedback, so even if you want to just bitch at us for 15 minutes, we'll take it.
Yes,
Twitter, Facebook, all that fun stuff for the contact there.
Yep, we'll put it in the show notes, but cardknocklifepodcast@gmail.com is a great way to reach us, and as is our Facebook, facebook.com/cardknocklifepodcast, and Twitter, card_knock_life with an @ in front of it and no spaces, as I understand that's how Twitter works.
That is, in fact, that's what it works.
And we'll work on getting our regulars back on here. They've had some obligations, but we'll see if we can get them on. We may have a guest or two, or you know, someone fill in so we can get to keep the liveliness going here, folks.
Yeah. All right. Bad beats are $1. Good night.